Blog Talk Radio.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious sh-
What's up, everybody? Welcome to a special show. I don't know. I'm always ready to say Punch Drunk Critics Live. I guess technically we are live and it is Punch Drunk Critics. So we missed you on Sunday night. We were out of the Virginia Film Festival. But today we are back with you. Travis and I are going to be talking to a very awesome person today, especially this time of year when we're just finding out now about the Disney Star Wars merger. One of the people that was involved in the creation of Yoda himself, Nick Malley. Am I saying that right, Malley, Travis?
I think it's Malley, but I'm not Malley. Sure, to be honest.
Yeah, I leave the pronunciations up to you generally. So, when you first told me that you met this guy out in St. Martin, said that he was creator Yoda, that's big enough, just being on the creative team that started Yoda. But this is a guy who's really been in a who's who, or what's what, if you will, of staple sci-fi Hollywood movies. I mean, yes. Everything from Superman to Highlander, this guy was in some way, shape, or form a part of, and that's pretty damn amazing, if you ask me.
Yeah, when I first went to St. Martin, I just happened to come across this place, the Yoda Guy movie exhibit, and I didn't know what the hell it was. Mm-hmm. But it was when I went there, it just happened to be on Good Friday, which on the island of St. Martin, nothing is open on Good Friday. It's basically a dead zone. So I was disappointed, and it was like my last day on the island, so I was kind of heartbroken. But I was fortunate enough to go back to St. Martin a few months later, and the place was open, and I was just hoping at that point that Nick was in the office that day, and he just happened to be, and I got a chance to talk to him and just visit the museum, which, you know, I think if you're a Star Wars fan, you really just need to go there. I mean, it's one of those places you have to put down on your list of places to go. He has everything from original script pages to replicas and all sorts of original material as well. I mean, the guy, he's far more than just his nickname, the Yoda Guy, as one of the people who helped, you know, design the original Yoda and build the models for it. Mm-hmm. He's more than that. His career is like, it's basically charting the course of science fiction history through looking at his career. It's quite amazing.
Yeah, and if you guys get a chance, if you look at you can take a look at his website that kind of shows some of the stuff that's on there. It's at netdwellers.com/mz/cinesecrets. That's CINESECRETS. Or you can just Google Nick Malley website, and it comes up as well. I definitely say you should take a look at it. Every island to me is kind of offers the same thing, you know, sun, surf, sand, girls, and bikinis. But now I have to have St. Martin, even known for its treacherous short landing strip at the airport. I really, really wanted to go check this museum out. And everybody knows I'm one of the top Star Wars nerds in the area. And even past that, I mean, the other stuff he's worked on, the museum looks amazing. I'm just really excited. I mean, the things this guy has seen, like, you know, we watch these movies, we can remember where we were when we saw them, you know, and not just Star Wars, all of these movies. But I wonder what it's like for this guy to look at these same iconic movies and say, I worked on that. I'm part of that. It's got to be something.
Yeah, it's got to be such an amazing feeling. To be able to look back on your career and say something like – and be able to say something like that. And Nick is actually contacting me now. Hold on. Go ahead and talk for a second. He's writing me now.
Just to break everything down, obviously we're going to be talking to Nick about the entirety of his career. But the big news, obviously, right now that we haven't got a chance to talk about yet is the Disney merger with Lucasfilm. I honestly, I've been putting something together in writing that I've rewritten about three times in the past week, because I honestly can't tell where I sit on this, because my very first, I think, Travis, I said this to you when you first told me about it, my very first reaction was Disney equals plush toys equals more Jar Jar Binkses. But the other part of me is thinking, maybe it won't be so. I mean, Pirates of the Caribbean, I know, is not going to be, make every Star Wars fan stand up and cheer. But if you think about it, there's a lot of dark stuff in there, too. I mean, those movies can be at points just as dark as Empire Strikes Back was. I think they know how to handle, after thinking about it a while, I think I've turned the page. I think they know how to handle certain things, and they know what they need to do to keep the fans happy as well. Because Disney's not a place that really pisses off its fans, if we're being honest. It's kind of silly that I was so surprised by it, because the writing was on the wall years ago. I mean, Disney World has had that Star Wars weekends down in Orlando. Their Star Tours ride was always a huge thing there. They've always had a connection to Lucasfilm and Star Wars. So, and certainly there's a lot of other properties that are getting picked up in this. I hear people talking about everything from Willow to the Indiana Jones trilogy, which has got some licensing or distribution things that are going to have to be worked out before that goes anywhere. But, I mean, Star Wars, I really moved from trying to figure out if I liked the idea or not to trying to figure out where they would go with it. As everybody knows, the original trilogy was the Luke Skywalker story arc, and the prequel trilogy was the Anakin Skywalker Darth Vader story arc.
Right.
Well, the Clone Wars is kind of covered the in-between. Oh, we did?
I believe so.
Okay.
I believe we're about to be joined by Nick Maley now. As we said, one of the important pieces of the Star Wars puzzle, Nick Maley, who I had a chance to meet a few months ago, and he's joining us now. Nick, how are you?
I'm good. Hopefully you can hear me.
I can hear you. We can hear you just fine. You're on with Travis Hobson, who I had a chance to meet you a few months ago, and my colleague, John Nolan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. How are you, John?
I'm doing great, Nick. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I'm a huge fan of pretty much everything that you've done that I'm looking at here. We were just talking a minute ago about how amazing the career span that you had was, and how we remember where we were when we watched most of these movies that you were a part of making. And
yeah,
how cool it must be for you to look at these same movies and say, I don't just know where I was. I was a part of making that. I mean, that's pretty – I mean, from everything from Superman to Crawl to Highlander to Star Wars is – I'm just in awe to be talking to you right now.
Well, you're very welcome. You know, I'm sitting here in the Caribbean working on another project at the moment that it probably will come to nothing, but I got caught up writing some music for that, and lo and behold, I got this little nudge that came in on Skype saying, you know, hello, where are you, kind of thing. So, okay, here I am.
I'm glad you could join us. I saw you on there, so I was like, oh, okay, well, at least I know he's there.
Yeah.
But I know how busy you get, and I know how busy it gets over there in St. Martin. Are the ships docking today?
No, it's a quiet day today. That's why it was a good day to talk. Tomorrow and a few days after, we have up to probably about 14,000 passengers a day.
Oh,
so that can get a little hectic sometimes. Although, you know, we're a non-profit foundation trying to encourage people to follow their dreams and be all they can be. And so we're always happy to get whatever support walks in through the door. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was telling John about the first time I went to St. Martin, and I just happened to come across the Yoda Guy movie exhibit. And it was on Good Friday, and nothing was open on the island.
Including me, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I came back to St. Martin a few months later, and thankfully, not only were you open, but you were in the office that day. It was my favorite day of that entire vacation, was getting a chance to visit the exhibit. Tell the people a little bit about the creation of the Yoda Guy exhibit and how it came to be.
Oh, it's a folly, really, in some ways. You know, that over the years, I get a lot of people that come and seek me out, originally through some galleries that I had in the Caribbean, art galleries. The ship started saying, oh, you know, you really ought to, you really ought to be mentioned on the ships, and you should tell people that you made these movies. And I said, well, you know, I'm sitting here living as an artist, why would I do that? And they say, well, because if you do, we'll tell all the people on the ship to come and see us. So they would explain to people about where the art gallery was and about me having been involved in Yoda, and they'd show a picture of me working on Yoda. And all these people would come off the ship and wander around saying, where's that Yoda guy? Where's that Yoda guy? And they'd say to locals, where's that Yoda guy? And they'd go, who? What? They wouldn't know what they were talking about. So we put that Yoda guy outside the gallery so that people knew what the hell they were talking about. And then as time went by, I found that they were asking me the same questions over and over again. And I was answering them in the same way, telling people that they should have faith in their impossible dreams, because the reason that they fail is because they give up. And it's not going to be easy. There is no easy key to being a success. Those people who, those heroes that you have at the Olympics actually got to go there because they went to the gym every day for 8 years and worked their butts off. And the same thing's true when it comes to, you know, you want to work in movies. Don't expect it to just to say, I want to be Marilyn Monroe, but I won't dye my hair until they offer me the job. You've got to get out there and make yourself everything you can and put yourself in the best possible place to shorten the odds so that you're in the right place at the right time when the opportunity passes by. And so we decided it would be nice to, since I'm getting older, we said, you know, I wonder how long I can keep doing this for, talking to people. I mean, I've still got a lot of life left in me, but I'm just turning into my 60s, and I'd say, am I still going to be able to do this when I'm in my 80s? So, you know, we thought we should virtualize Nick and put him on as a series of DVDs, telling the inside story about the making of movies, and put out there some of the stuff that we collected from some of the movies I made and some of the movies that friends had made. And so if it was going to be a museum, well, we needed to be able to pay the rent in the off-season, so we needed to be somewhere that had a good amount of traffic, and that's what brought us to St. Martin.
So how does a career, like, as legendary as yours, how does it begin? What got you into doing what you do?
I think you get an interest in a particular subject, even though you don't know exactly where your niche may fall within it. My dad was an actor, and I grew up backstage telling jokes and at school and play acting in all the school plays. And I wasn't going to have some teacher do my makeup, because what the hell did she know about stage makeup? I was 7 years old, but I hung out with actors all the time. So, you know, I learned how to do my own, make my own beards for the Three Wise Men or whatever pantomime they were putting on. And it really started there. As I got to being 18, I suddenly realized that people had lied to me for the largest part of my life. And I wasn't going to be tall and handsome. And that if I was going to work as an actor, I was going to be unemployed most of the time. And so I started what skills I had that would allow me to work in the business. Around that same time, my dad got sick, and he was teaching at drama schools as well as acting. And I took over all his classes teaching stage makeup when I was 18, and was teaching at what's now Middlesex University in England. And so I'm a big believer in saying to people, look at what you've got and see what you can use that you have that will get you a tiny bit closer to where you want to go. And so, you know, I said to myself, what have I got? Well, I guess what I've got is that I'm an 18-year-old guy teaching at college. So I went and banged the door of all the people that give out union tickets for making movies and said, I'm an 18-year-old guy who's teaching at college. Don't you think you ought to give me a union card? And so, you know, inch by inch, eventually after 2 years of harassing, they gave me a union card, but I still didn't know anybody that made movies, so I was still unemployed. But I also look at what you've got. I had a list of all the people who could give me work. And so I started to study the trade mags and see what movies were being made where and who was making them. And I would save up a few dollars to go wherever I knew I would bump into them, just so that they knew who the hell I was. And I knew that one day, if I did it enough, there'd be a time when all their friends were busy and they needed an extra hand. And when they looked at the names of the people they didn't know, they'd see my name there and they'd be more familiar than the others. So they'd give me the job.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It was a number of years. You know, if you really want to do something, you just inch closer and closer and closer to it, and eventually you're there.
Talk to me about your work with Star Wars. Obviously, you're known as the Yoda guy for a reason. What part did you play?
I wasn't the only Yoda guy. There was a team of us that were building creatures for the principal photography that was done in England. One of the guys targeted, once I got that list of names, was the guy who built the apes for 2001, A Space Odyssey, back in 1968. And that's the beginnings of a lot of the technology that was used on Star Wars. And I knew that he would get all the best jobs. And so I harassed him for 2 years to encourage him to let me carry his bag. And basically, I carried his bag, Star Wars. I was the new kid on the block of a team of about six people building the creatures for the Mos Eisley Cantina, and we were building Chewbacca as well. And so I got to hang out with George Lucas and the rest of those guys. At the time, it was just another movie. You know, we didn't know that Star Wars was going to be this big blockbuster for about a year and a half after we'd made it, because it took that long for it to be a big success in the US and then come to Europe, where those people who made it were. And so it was really about 2 years after we made that movie that we were suddenly very popular people and everybody wanted to employ us. The first Star Wars, second Star Wars, we went on and made the first Superman movie and half of the second. And I did another thing with Stu for Gene Roddenberry. So by the time we got to the second one, instead of being the new block, I was a trusted member of the crew. My boss was the mastermind behind all the creatures. His son was number two, and I had a whole bunch of new people who came and joined us. So I thought what I was going to do on Yoda was to make the molds and the skins and the skull. My boss mocked him and spent a long time doing it, and I did that part of it. And we thought there was only going to be one Yoda, but ultimately they wanted to see Yoda's legs working. And so they asked my boss if he could make a walking Yoda. And he was busy trying to build the world's first animatronic puppet and said, no, I'm afraid we, you know, there's only three of us and some trainees and we don't have time. And my boss's son was working on the set, looking after things that we'd built. They came to me as the other guy in the workshop and said, can you figure out some way to do this? And I said, well, why are you thinking about building a mechanical figure? You know, why can't we? Nobody knows how tall Yoda is. So as long as he's not standing next to Luke, we could do a figure in a, we could do a midget in a suit and have him walk through the trees and you'd never know the difference. So that was the first Yoda that I built, a midget called Deep Roy. And for about 25 years, no one actually knew that there was that version of Yoda. Deep Roy started doing autographs as Yoda.
That'll put it out there.
I'd been telling people that we'd done it that way. for that one shot of him walking through the trees when Luke first meets him and he wanders off and Luke's thinking, shall I follow you or not? And that was put in that way just so you could see him walking and believe that Yoda had legs instead of being a puppet with Frank Oz, his arm stuffed up his backside. So, a strange thing, I was recently in Orlando doing autographs at Celebration 6, and someone came up to me and laid on the table photographs Deep Roy in that suit. So this is
wow.
35 years later, suddenly those photos came back to me. So I was absolutely thrilled to see those. Anyway, that's by the by. Part of that, because I'd done that, they asked me if I would work with the radio control tech to make the version of Yoda that was in Luke's backpack while my boss was working on the world's first animatronic puppet. And some of the parts that we'd made, and he built the mechanism. This is a gentleman called Ron Hone, built the radio controlled mechanism, and I did the final assembly on that. So having built two versions, when the world's first animatronic puppet had a few hiccups, and they felt that it would be wise to have a backup, they asked me if I could make a backup for it, and that was the third one that I worked on. So those pictures of me working on the radio-controlled version and the others are how I came to be known as that Yoda guy, but we mustn't overlook all the other Yoda guys. Wendy Midner, who was deeply involved in building Yoda, she was the person who was the liaison between the Muppets and us, and she built the bodies for Miss Piggy and other characters for the Muppets, and so she built the body while we were building the head. She contributed by talking about different things. I think the ear mechanism came from Wendy too. And Graham Freeborn, my boss's son, who did a lot of the artwork and laid the hair and other stuff. In fact, I write about that on another one of my websites called Those Yoda Guys.
you got a lot of websites, though. I mean, you also have Cine Secrets, right? You still have Cine Secrets up, don't you?
Yes, yeah, Cine Secrets is one we're trying to revamp not as a blog so much as a podcast. But I don't have enough time to put everything up there yet. A lot of the videos that we put up in the museum, I'm hoping eventually I can put up there. But it's a bit of a trial at the moment. We have to see whether we get enough people to go look at Cine Secrets or pull up the basically the same stuff is on YouTube/CineSecrets, where you know we feed that those videos from, and of course my main website is thatyodaguy.com, where we've got a blog that tells the inside stories about a lot of movies too. So it's all a kind of, when you put it all together, it all complements each other. It's just different ways of accessing the same information, really.
You know, I'm fighting the urge, not because I'm such a Star Wars fan, I'm fighting the urge not to stay just with Star Wars. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about your work on Krull. That movie has some of the coolest design things I think I've ever seen, from the glaive weapon all the way through everything. But you did some work on the Beast and then also Cyclops, correct?
I designed all the creatures for Krull.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
That was the first movie where I was the head of department designing everything, and they gave me a $40 million movie back in 1983, when $40 million was a hell of a lot of money. And they had some technical difficulties when they had someone else started to build the creatures for it, and I think they had a falling out, and they asked me to take the movie over with just 6 weeks left to go, and they let me do pretty well anything I felt. It was a dream. It was a great movie for me. I loved doing it. It was probably the happiest movie that I worked on. I had a crew of about 15 on that, and we just muddled in and did everything. And it's one of those movies that I thought everybody had forgotten about, but I get an awful lot of guys in their 30s who come in and tell me how much they wanted a glaive when they were a little boy.
I still want one.
I did. I still want one, too. I still want one.
I remember a couple of years back, I was looking in a sci-fi gift magazine type deal, and they were selling replicas of the glaive, and my wife thought I would probably stab myself if I had it, so she wouldn't let me get it, but I was fighting her for that. But like the how do you approach making the creatures? The reason I ask is I noticed, especially in the Cyclops in Krull, it seems it's probably the best looking one, and it really set the stage for the Cyclopses to come because it looks more organic. I'll say just like the wrinkles around the eyes that make it look like a human eye, but it's on both sides. You know, that's kind of stuff that was left out before. And I was just wondering, like, do you take like a biological approach to it, where you try to relate it to something here, or how do you start designing these creatures?
When you design any creature, you have to start with the limitations. A simple analogy, there's no point in designing the best-looking car if there's no room for the people to get in. If there's room for the engine, right? Uh-huh. Might look great, but, you know, you have to start with what you've got to get in there. And so you have to decide, is this the stop motion? Because if it's stop motion, all you've got to do is put an armature in it. Or is it going to, today, of course, people can do anything they want because they just animate it all on a computer. But when you're physically building something, you have to say, how are we going to make this? Is this going to be built on a guy? Well, if it is, then we have to start with the guy. And so if you're building the beast, and the beast, you want to have a little tiny waist, so that people can't believe that you could have got a guy inside, well, then I started with the skinniest female dancer that I could find so that I could put shoulders out and work that other way. In the case of Chewbacca, you needed someone that was very tall. So you had to start with, in fact, I recommended my friend Peter Mayhew to play that part, who was 7'2". Mm-hmm. And so you start with Peter, and you build the rest around it. In this particular case, we had the actor Bernard Breslau, who was very well known in England as a comedian. And I started with his head, saying, okay, now I'm going to put a single eye on this, and I need to take his structure, the structure of his face away. And so you then start to look at what illusions you can create that lead the audience to, who are naturally sitting there trying to figure out how you did it, to lead their eye to away from what you're really doing, and to make them look elsewhere or feel that something is done in a different way. In terms of the Cyclops, because I wanted to put a mechanism in, I couldn't drill Bernard's brains out. With his forehead. Then I said, okay, well, we're going to build the top of his head up, which means we're going to change the proportions of the head. So by placing another 2 inches, 2.5 inches to the top of his head, I moved where you looked for his eyes. The eye isn't between his eyes. The eye is effectively in the middle of his forehead. And then I actually built a set of spectacles into the face underneath the eye, because Bernard was blind without his glasses. And so I had to get lenses that were his prescription and mount them into the mask. And I actually, the reason those wrinkles are on each side, apart from looking right, organically looking right, is because he's actually looking out through those wrinkles.
Oh, you're kidding. See, I'm actually looking at a picture of it right now. It's amazing that you could do that. Because, I mean, I've worn, you know, obviously only a cheap Halloween mask, but even if it's got a wide hole, you can't really see. And you build glasses into that. That's, I'm just going to slightly amaze here. But you also answered a question that I've always wondered why. You know, I don't think either Travis or I are really a huge fan of CGI stuff. I
not
absolutely
really.
Love movies, especially lately, that have practical effects in them. And I think you just answered why I can't get used to CGI, and that's that you said you start the whole process by building toward a person, building toward the actor or what your limitations are, which maybe it's just a side effect. Probably gives it a more grounded feel and lets you believe it more than something that really has no limitations. So thank you for answering that question. I've been wondering a long time.
Well, something else with CGI. So you don't have really a solid structure inside that limits you from allowing the neck to get longer when you're surprised or the eyes to pop out. Or, you know, animated really cannot resist that tendency of turning stuff into a cartoon. That, you know, some of them really try, but, you know, there's always that element that takes you beyond reality. They jump too far or they do too many faults, or they take you to a point that is just beyond belief. And stretched credibility to a level that is too far. I think the best effects that I've seen were done after most of my movies in things like Terminator 2, where they took really brilliant animatronics that had been developed, you know, over the years, and then digitally enhanced them. I often say to people who are big CGI fans, I say, let's just talk for a moment about Babe. You know, Babe was the movie that did have some animatronics in it. Not a great deal, but it did have some animatronics in it. But would Babe have been a better movie if they had taken all the live pigs and animals out and replaced them with cartoons?
No, absolutely not.
It absolutely wouldn't. It was the reality of the way a pig walks and the way it wiggles its tail and the way it turns its head with the fantastic CGI animations that they added to the faces that made you believe that they talked and they did those other things. It was just a brilliant, brilliant job. You know, when I see follow-ups and other things where everything is done CGI, you know, I may be a dinosaur, but I'm disappointed. I have seen stuff that is better than that. And actually, when we do make stuff that's completely believable, then we're all in trouble because then, you know, ultimately we can't believe anything we see on CNN either.
Yeah.
Do you feel like... I feel like at a certain point, everything was CGI for a while there. But it seems like there may be sort of a turn back towards more practical effects lately. I think people are starting to like the old ways again.
Men in Black 3, they did a combination again on that. And the Hellboy movie, they did a lot of effects in those.
Right. Del Toro's a guy who prefers practical effects more so than CGI, it seems.
Yeah, not coincidentally, he has some of the best stuff recently.
Sorry, say that again?
I was saying, and not coincidentally, Del Toro has some of the best-looking stuff on screen that we've seen in the last 10 years, because, you know, he does like to use practical effects. I mean, even with stuff like Where the Wild Things Are that came back, where they use, like, a hybrid, I even think that is almost an acceptable way to go if they have to use the CGI, where they just do the eyes or something they want to do a certain way. But I would love to see it come back.
There is definitely a place for CGI. We shouldn't be considering, you know, throwing it away or anything like that. Someone to me one time, oh, well, you know, Yoda had to be CGI in episode two because otherwise he couldn't have done those somersaults. You know, obviously they didn't think Terminator did in Terminator 2 because he did a few things more than, you know, that were, you know,
right.
that were really very believable. And you do it by using all your different cinematic tricks of cutting different things together. And so you cut your puppet together, your some enhancement to your CGI doing the somersault, to your puppet landing, to the reaction from the live actor, to, you know, and when you put that together, it is much more believable than anything else. It really is.
When I've always said that scene where Yoda is in that fight in episode, I believe it's episode two, and he's doing all those somersaults and flips, is one of those moments that totally took me out of the movie. It just did not look right to me. Like, it just seemed like they were saying, well, we can do this, so let's go ahead and do it, whether or not it made sense or not.
Yeah,
so
go ahead, Nick.
I don't like to say anything to put, you know, George Lucas or Lucasfilm down in any way,
right.
because, you know, they're the ones that made all the money, and I'm sitting here trying to run a meeting. You know, how be? But, you know, the truth of the matter is that, you know, I think a lot of adults would have liked to have seen that done more the way that the originals were. I did recommend on episode one that they kept Yoda as a puppet, and they did do that. But unfortunately, mm-hmm. they built didn't look anything like the original. And ultimately, the CGI that they did in episode two, I felt better with it. Finally, up when they did Blu-ray that was in episode one.
Yeah, it definitely looked a lot better too. I have nothing bad to say about Lucasfilm as they fueled my childhood and most of my adulthood to this point. But it's just like the thing is with Yoda. It seems like when people use CGI as opposed to practical effects, it does another thing as a side effect, and that's it. Kind of is like a kid with a new toy. Like in my opinion, at least, you know, Yoda has always been portrayed, and then Yoda we knew was somebody that didn't have to do all that. Like he would, you know, use the Force or whatever. But, you know, being able to do everything is almost like a Pandora's box at some point. And I'm just using this as an example. In a lot of places, we see a lot of things that when it comes on screen, it kind of takes you to an out of the movie, like Travis was saying, because you're like, well, that wouldn't really happen. And that's one of the things with practical effects. I'm such a fanboy for practical effects. Every time I go to Universal Studios in Florida there, they have this monster creation show I watch every time. It's amazing what you guys have done. And even with something, I'm just kind of taken aback because even like in as a kid, I remember certain VHS covers, and Krull is one of the main ones I know. And it had the beast on the front. It's just so, everything is so amazing looking when people make the creatures of practical. I don't get the CGI, but that's just me.
I feel that one has to make that you can't be a dinosaur and sit back and just say otherwise. Just say, well, that's the way we do it. Otherwise, we steal all these things. And as on some Ray Harryhausen movies too, but we, you know, we'd still all be just doing that. But there is. It has its place, but I really believe that it needs to be an enhancement and an addition to physical stuff. That's just, you know, that's just my mindset as a builder. And I know people like Rick Baker, you've just got to look at what they're doing to see that they all feel the same way. There's also not a lot of fun sitting at a computer pressing buttons in comparison with getting your hands dirty and, you know, and building stuff and messing around. You know, we on Superman, Graham Freeborn modeled a whole load of muscles for Chris Reeve because we didn't think he'd put on enough weight to play the part without us putting prosthetic muscles on him for the first Superman movie. And, you know, there was a lot of fun when the two of us put them on and went to the bar. There's stuff like
oh, man.
Doing it in a computer and just sitting and watching it. It's just not, exciting thing. And I think those of us who made a living doing this, we were really initially inspired by the fun of what we were doing, not just the fact that we could earn some money and people would pat us on the back.
Obviously, this is an exciting time to be a Star Wars fan again, with the recent announcements and all that stuff about Episode 7. Were you surprised by any of that? Were you surprised by what happened?
I've been telling people for 10 years to expect Episode 7 by 2018. Mm-hmm. To be quite honest, I thought it would probably be 2017. So 2015, mm-hmm. I wasn't expecting that. But, you know, it's still the same thing. You know, it's very simple. I all these people saying, oh, but George Lucas says he won't make it anymore. I said, did you actually? I said, oh, no, but one reported that. I said, oh, really? And did they report that he said, no, I won't make another Star Wars? You know, because those are exactly the same words that mean two entirely different things. And
right.
And possibility that anyone would decide to turn down making another $20 billion over another Star Wars trilogy to say, oh, no, they won't do it because, you know, George is going to be too old. When he has animatics, he could have laid out the storylines for mm-hmm. the next 10 years ago and have them sitting in a computer program, which may have bought along with everything else that is... that is Lucasfilm. So, you know, there's no reason. George Lucas could be dead and they could still make 7, 8, and 9 the way that he only wanted them made. So, no, I wasn't surprised by any of that at all. A lot of those people that I'd been telling didn't believe me, sending me emails saying, you were right.
Well, we actually, it was one of the things we talked about when I was there, was that we both were like adamant that they were going to do another one. But I think the fact that they're targeting 2015, which is really fast, you would think, for something like this, probably speaks to the fact that maybe there already is that outline for the next movie. Like you were saying, there probably is something that's already in place.
You know, in the museum, amongst other things, we have the press release where George said when Episode 6 came out that mm-hmm. it completed the first trilogy of three trilogies.
Mm-hmm. Right.
After that, everybody said, oh, no, they're only making 6. And, you know, it was great publicity when Episode 3 was coming out. This is the last one there'll ever be. You better go and see it. And, you know... They said it was going to be the last one, you know, but they said that, the third one was going to be called Revenge of the Jedi, too. So, you know, you can't always believe everything you hear. No, I wasn't surprised by it at all, but I was a little surprised that it was Disney. I can understand why Disney, because they've had a lot of links to Disney. I'm not sure whether that's good for Star Wars fans or not, since, you know, Star Wars will become just another Disney line, like Mickey Mouse, instead of being, you know, an entity within its own right. I'm not sure where that will go. I don't think the Muppets did terribly well by being taken over by Disney. Disney is listening. I don't really mean any of this. Anyway,
Nick, you there?
I'm still here.
Oh, okay. Sorry,
there you go.
I do have one quick question. What do you think the smart money is on where this next trilogy will take us? What part? Obviously, we've seen the Anakin Skywalker storyline. We've seen the Luke Skywalker storyline. Where do we see this next trilogy falling in time-wise, do you think?
Oh, time-wise, it's 40 years after Episode 6.
40 years after Return of the Jedi, so New Jedi Order. That's where I put my money. That would be amazing.
This is how I knew that it was supposed to come out in around 2017, because it's the 40th anniversary of the making of the first Star Wars, and all the original actors are 40 years older, ready to play the same characters 40 years later, which is a brilliant idea. No one ever did that before. There's been stories like Harrison Ford said he wouldn't make another Star Wars movie, but, you know, Disney's got a lot of money and he might change his mind. And I'm sure that I was talking to Mark Hamill just about 5-6 weeks ago, and I would be surprised if he decided that he didn't want to come back as Luke at the Jedi Academy or wherever they take the story from there. More than that, I really couldn't tell you, except that I thought that in episode one, talking about, you know, this savior of sorts who was going to bring balance to the Force, really opened the door for the story to go somewhere else. All those people who think that, Darth Vader was the savior, it really doesn't seem too, likely. I mean, we've got all these kids now that were 8 years old when episode one came out, who all think it's okay to go around killing all the children as long as they repent before they die. And we really have to put that package in place and make sure that, we get back to supporting the good side instead of all those bad guys. All the people that come in, they all want to be Darth Vader or Darth Maul.
I love that point of view. It's definitely time for us to start to supporting the good guys again. I can agree with that 100%.
The whole nature of George's movies for Star Wars is cyclic. I don't know if people have really, really analyzed that or not. But the very first movie ended with an upbeat. The second one was a downbeat, and the third one was an upbeat. Fourth one, of course, was episode one, was a downbeat. The fifth one was an upbeat. And, of course, episode three was a big downbeat. You know, you can see how they go one by one by one. We're all set for an upbeat. And that's the way it should be. If we're going to end Star Wars, let's end it on a positive note, not on a note where everybody feels that they should. It's nice for kids to have lightsabers so they can cut each other's legs off and be Darth Vader.
I am 100% agreeance with you on that.
Absolutely. Nick, obviously this has been a fantastic time talking to you, man. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us for this last 30-40 minutes. It's been great for both of us, I'm sure.
I don't think it's fully sunk in yet that we've been talking to you for this past 30 minutes. We appreciate it. It's probably one of the biggest thrills that I've had since I started working with movies, is talking to you right now of all the things you've done. I can't tell you how much we appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate that anyway. Thanks for inviting me, and I'll see you guys when you're next in St. Martin.
Absolutely, man. And if this project of yours comes around, I hope we get a chance to talk to you again.
Sure. We'll see how it goes.
All right. Thanks a lot, Nick. I'll keep in touch. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. Thank you.
And that was Nick, Nick Mealy, the Yoda guy. That was a lot of fun. I mean, that's all I'm going to say. That was a lot of fun, having a chance to talk to him about Star Wars and getting a chance to hear him discuss his career and not just that, but his whole attitude towards creature design and makeup and special effects, all that stuff, I thought was just amazing.
Yeah, if anybody noticed, I was being a little bit quieter than my usual self.
that was because I wasn't – sometimes when you do this job, you don't really think you're in the moment you're in. And as I'm talking to this guy more and more, I'm looking at the stuff he's done. And, I mean, it was kind of – out of the blue there, I dropped the whole thing about seeing the Kroll VHS. I mean, that's I've told you 100 times. You know, I remember movies from my childhood as VHS covers walking through the video store, and that Kroll cover is one of the most iconic in my mind that I can remember. And I mean, he designed the whole thing. He designed Yoda, and what a great guy. You know, just so open to talking about everything. Obviously, very excited about it all. And really. One of the pillars, I should say, of the. I mean, the 80s was the best time for from that creature creation, and he was one of the pillars of it. It looks like.
Yeah, absolutely, man. So I was especially interested in hearing his thoughts on episode 7. Like I said, we kind of knew he wouldn't be surprised by it, but it's always interesting to hear that he talked to Mark Hamill as recently as just a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And he keeps in touch with those guys, and that he thinks Hamill will be back.
Yeah.
For another one.
That's a huge, huge drop. At least I haven't heard anything, any informed people responding about the timeline of it. And the 40 years after, I know I'm probably one of 10% of Star Wars fans that knows a lot about the EU. I know you know a lot about it, too. Is the new Jedi Order era is... I mean, we're talking that Han and Leia have kids now. Luke is a master at the Jedi Academy. There's great stories in there. But when I kind of dismissed it when I was thinking about it because of Harrison Ford. I mean, you can't recast Han Solo. You just can't.
Yeah. But then again, according to the press release and all that stuff, they're not going to be doing any – it's not going to be any official adaptations of novelizations. So, I mean, maybe they'll take some elements from it. We don't know. But they're not going to be doing any adaptations of any of the books, unfortunately.
Right.
I mean, the new Jedi Order would have been a way to go that I think would have been a smart way to go if they were going to. But it doesn't look like they're going to do it. But
well, even if they don't,
I think they might take parts of it. I wouldn't be surprised by that.
Yeah, I guess what I meant was more like less of an adaptation of the book, but more of a kind of keep the liner notes. But even then, I mean, I think it's hard to make anything in the future unless you don't include anybody, which would be even harder. Obviously, the only people that you could include far in the future are R2 and 3PO. But, you know, it's kind of a rock and a hard place because on one hand, you know, I don't think Han Solo would deprive all the fans of that and all the money that he would get of that. But he has been very vocal about not wanting – I mean, he wanted Han Solo to die in Return of the Jedi. And, you know, that's why they put him in Carbonite was because they didn't know if he was going to come back for Episode 6. And just it's a rock and a hard place because you can't kill Han Solo off screen. You can't start out and say in your opening crawl, say it's been 40 years since this and Han Solo died doing this. I mean, he's too invested for people. So it'd be interesting to see where they go with it or if it's even in that timeline. But
yeah.
I think it's the most likely place to go.
Yeah, no, I think you could be right on that. There's obviously going to be a lot of speculation, and I don't think we're going to find out any concrete answers until we start hearing about a potential director. Mm. And even a screenwriter, I mean, I would say, because like Nick was saying, Lucas could have had this thing mapped out a decade ago.
Yeah.
You know, and but we don't know necessarily if Disney's going to be using what Lucas, you know, had mapped out. Mm-hmm. We just don't know. We don't know what avenue they're taking. They might decided to go in a totally different direction, and it'd be their prerogative to do so and their ability to do so. They don't have to follow what Lucas had planned. Now, they might want to do that because, you know, obviously keeping Lucas's name as prominent as possible can only help matters in terms of selling it. Not that they would need help in selling Star Wars, but it would certainly help if people felt like it was something that sprung from the mind of George Lucas. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see where this thing goes. And I get that. I recognize the irony in me saying all that, considering I've been someone who wants George Lucas away from Star Wars for years.
Right.
I've been wanting him to get away from it. That I think Disney would be smart in keeping his name attached to it in some way. I recognize that, and that's just kind of how it is.
Yeah. It's kind of like it's kind of like, you know, how you would treat a daughter. You know, Star Wars is like you want to let her get out on her own, but you don't want anybody else to help her. You know what I mean? And I can definitely understand that. I mean, what he said was legit. Fact is that, you know, when Lucas first came out years and years ago, he said it's the first of three trilogies, which led to a whole bunch of speculation. And actually, the original idea, the original outline did cover all nine of those. So somewhere that outline is there. It's called the Journal of the Wills, I believe, when he originally wrote it. And it outlined what we saw in the prequels, what we saw in the original trilogy, and what was to be seen in the third trilogy. Unfortunately, because it never got anywhere to production, it's very top secret what that third part was about. So we don't even know storyline or anything like that. But my biggest problem with Disney taking over is, you know, I think they actually do give a lot of care to what fans would like. They do have brands that take out of the Mickey Mouse area. And one of their most popular characters at the park on Star Wars weekends is Darth Vader. So they're not really scared to bring the darkness there. But the thing I'm scared of most is the very, very opening credits. It's so... And this is going to sound so stupid to everybody, I know. But one of the things that sets me in the mood for Star Wars is the 20th Century Fox logo, and then followed by that slow Lucasfilm green logo. And if it's not before Star Wars, I'm not going to be in the right mood.
I don't think you have to worry about that. They're not going to change that. They're not going to have Mickey Mouse on the steamship right before it starts. I don't think you have to worry about that.
I'm sure I'll castle with that. That doesn't work before.
I don't think they're going to change something as, you know, pivotal as that. I mean, it does seem trivial, but, you know, to Star Wars fans, something like that's one of those things you just wouldn't change, I don't think. Mm-hmm. I don't think Disney will do it. But now, would I be surprised if they did a... If they did a short film before one of the Star Wars movies? No. But speaking seriously, considering this is Disney, I actually kind of expect that they will put a short film in front of it. But it will be a Star Wars-related short film, animated, because they're going to be doing that stuff.
I'm 100% okay with that.
They're going to be doing that. We're going to see more Star Wars than a lot of us can handle, and I'm worried about it being overload, to be honest. But they're going to be doing more animated spinoffs and sequels and tie-ins and things like that, and TV shows. It's not going to stop. It's just going to get bigger. And I think one thing that we have to consider, and I know, and I believe Nick when he talks about the third trilogy and all that stuff. There's probably going to be more than a third trilogy.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it'll make money.
Right, it's going to go, and since it's Star Wars, it'll never stop making money. Mm-hmm. There's you don't see them stopping Star Trek movies.
Right.
You don't see them stopping James Bond movies. These things aren't going to go away, and there's no reason why you would ever limit Star Wars. I mean, it's more lucrative than both of those things.
It'll be a rough patch.
There's no reason why it'll stop.
The first movies outside of this next trilogy will be a rough patch just because, and you made perfect examples there about James Bond and Star Trek, but it'll be like when Star Trek The Next Generation first came out. Like the next trilogy after the Skywalker story is over has to be good or else it's gonna go bad really quickly. But two things about Disney, a good thing and a bad thing. A good thing is that we all know how Lucasfilm, or LucasArts, I should say, is on releasing Star Wars games and the quality of them. One good thing is that they did keep all the staff from Lucasfilm, or at least most of it. And I myself have been waiting for that Battlefield 3 game for years. Hopefully that'll start to happen. Bad news, folks. That whole, all you that bitched about Lucas not releasing him on Blu-ray and not releasing him to him on this time or doing that, I have two words for you. Disney Vault. That's it. Try to buy Snow White on a year that Snow White's not being sold, and you'll see what I'm talking about.
All right, well, we're closing in on 3 o'clock here, and I think we're probably about a good time to wrap this thing up. It's been an hour. It's been a lot of fun. I've been wanting to get Nick on this show since I first met him, and I'm glad I finally got a chance to have it on. And I hope we can make this not a regular thing, but maybe stop in and have him talk with us every few months and just get his thoughts on not just Star Wars and things like that, but on sci-fi and fantasy and the development of these movies in general, because obviously he still has a lot of opinions and thoughts on that. So I think hopefully we can do that in the future and have him on some more.
I think that would be amazing. I mean, he's obviously, like most of the best artists in the field are, he seems to be at first a true fan of not just what he does, but of the genre. And if we could get him on as like a sci-fi consultant on certain stuff, that would be top of the line for me.
Yeah, absolutely. So this has been great. We'll be back, this Sunday, right?
Yes.
We'll be back this Sunday.
This Sunday.
Yeah, for what comes out this week? Oh,
Skyfall and Lincoln.
It's a big week for movies. Skyfall and Lincoln are the two major movies this week, and we'll have reviews of both of those. So stay tuned, as always. Tune in on Sunday nights.
Yes.
It should be fun.
And speaking of Skyfall, guys, you have almost exactly 24 hours left to sign up for the contest. We've got a lot of great entries in so far. Make sure you sign up on the website, punchdrunkcritics.com, and not on the Facebook page. We will not see it if you only post there.
Right. And I will be there, even though I've already seen the movie and I've reviewed it on Around Town and all that stuff already. I'm going to see it again because it's that good. So I will be so I will be there that day.
How are y'all scooping us in Around Town when you're supposed to follow the same rules we are?
Well, it's not it hasn't aired yet, but we've already recorded it. So
especially it's already been out in Britain for a week where it's broken all kinds of records.
Yeah.
Not surprisingly, but you know, damn it, that's the one thing I did want to ask Nick about. he did work on The Man with the Golden Gun.
Yes, he did. He did some work on the James Bond film, and I was going to ask him about that too, and I never really got a chance to get around to it. Maybe some other time we'll get a chance to talk to him about it.
Definitely. So until Sunday, guys, blogtalkradio.com/punchdrunkcritics, every day at punchdrunkcritics.com. On Facebook, search for Punch Drunk Critics. Thank you for joining us. Travis, you got anything else?
Nope. We're out of here.
Amazing day. We're out of here. Thanks.
We came, we saw, we kicked its ass.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
I'm not great at farewell, so that'll do, pig.
That's the worst goodbye I've ever heard. And you stole it from a movie.